We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovix. Joining me today is Jaime Carrasco, Portfolio Manager at Canaccord Genuity. Thanks for joining me today, Jaime.
Thanks for having me back, Tom. It's been great and on a special day now that the Fed is at it again. The show is on once more. Act what, 357 or something? And we're still waiting for the funny words that they're going to say or the, you know, whatever. I just find it very interesting.
Absolutely. And that's, I guess that's a problem is that we do live in such interesting times, right? And I'm sure all of the Fed's words are going to be scrutinized very closely today as we see them announce the tapering schedule. Of course, we're speaking on the morning of Thursday, the 15th. This probably won't come out for a little bit here, but you know, it every time we see an FOMC meeting lately and we see the Fed trying to combat inflation, it seems, you know, gold gets just hammered coming into that. It's really interesting. But you know, when we think about all of these imbalances that we see when we look out over the financial landscape, does this environment play into a more leveraged scenario the longer it continues for gold and silver?
You know what, that's a really good question. And let's come back to it in a second, because I think I've been doing a lot of year-end reviews with clients. And I just did a big review with one of my oldest clients, one of my biggest clients. He's been with me since about 1995, late 94. He was the first people that in 1994, I started managing the defined contribution plan for a then little company called Microsoft Canada. And it's funny because we were doing a review of our gold positions and we got talking about blockchain and the markets and everything. And we got talking about the human emotions that I saw with all the employees. I managed their pension from 1995 right through to 2002. So the whole cycle of the internet being built out on the whole high-tech upside. And what was really interesting was how people's approach to wealth as the value of the stock started growing, right? So the first interesting point was that around 1996, 1997, you know, you had a lot of employees in their 20s that had been given a couple of options, 10,000 options here and there. But by then it had grown to a couple of $100,000. And these people had never had that amount of money, right? To me, what I was looking at was the build out of the internet, how the internet was getting going and Microsoft was benefiting because computers needed to get connected. Windows 95 offered an electronic and the earnings were growing. But on the other side, what people were looking at was the value of their shares in the stock was becoming so big. And, you know, people were saying, I've never had this kind of money. I got to sell. I think it's going to go down. Mm-hmm. Now, it's important because that line that there's two lines. One is that bull markets always ride a wall of fear. And that was so important because their big issue, oh, I've made so much money. So my advice to them was, well, why don't you pay off your house? Have that as your main priority. Buy out your house. Okay. So a lot of people did that. Now, time continues going, and then the attitudes start changing because now, 97, 98 come around, 1999. And then the attitude had changed because people did not want to sell their stock. They were making a lot of money. As a matter of fact, the biggest complaint of the ones that had paid off their house by then was that a $300,000 home in Microsoft stock would have grown into about $3 to $5 million worth of share price. So they felt they had missed out, right? So again, it's that human emotion, and it's exactly what I'm sensing and what I'm listening to and what I'm hearing with regards to blockchain, right? When it comes to blockchain to me is the internet 2.0, and it's being built out in a much better way. It's going to have much more impact. And the best thing is that when you look at the internet, we could only function or participate by buying the right company instead of participating in the growth of the internet itself. Mm-hmm. The beauty of the decentralized world that we're building, and when I don't think we can stop it, is that we can participate directly in the ownership of the blockchain. Now, we get to 1998, 1999, and by then, you know, the attitude was, oh, I don't want to sell my stock because this is going to go on forever. Well, that's exactly what we're listening to today with regards to the stock market, right? when it comes to the stock market, oh, you know, when it came down 1,000 points, what was the big thing? Oh, great, I can catch this down to buy a little bit more because it's going to go on forever. Well, we get to the year 2000, and at that point, the stock's trading at 95. Now, pre-split, it had grown to about $2,000, but it's trading around $95. So with my partner and I, we went to BMO, and we put together a call forward strategy to say to people, hey, why don't you sell 80% of your position, and you won't have to pay the taxes for 5 years. Now, the stock's trading at 95. We made an offer that they were going to sell them, buy them out at about $120. Well, you know what came back was that, well, by the year end, the stock's going to be at about 150. Why am I going to sell? Well, guess what? At that 95 mark at the beginning of the year 2000, the stock doesn't hit 95 again for almost 15 years later. So it took that long a time, but the attitude had changed. Mm-hmm. And that's what's important, because what I'm sensing right now is that when it comes to blockchain, is that wall of fear, which I find very healthy. I'm not concerned about blockchain, because if you look at the level of transactions that are occurring on the blockchain, they're growing exponentially faster than the internet. So to me, that's very healthy, and everything else is just price fluctuation. Mm-hmm. What's interesting also is the fact that at the top of the market, we had that complete ambivalence as to valuations, and nobody cared because, oh, it's going to go on forever. Now, the interesting part is the transition that we went through around 98, 99, where growth had been king for a long time. And I'm trying to get people into the Warren Buffett style of value management. Well, guess what? Nobody wanted to buy value. When I look at the gold stocks today, that's exactly what I'm looking at, because that is where the true value is. You know, if you look at the chart between where the gold companies are trading to where gold is trading, they're trading as though gold's sitting at $700, right? Mm-hmm. And gold is not going to stay down here for much longer because of the inflationary pressures. Now, everybody says, well, it's different this time. Well, you know what? Central banks around the world are buying physical. The Chinese are buying physical. The geopolitics are playing out. And as I've continued to argue, all markets have been manipulating by trillions and trillions and trillions of money that has been funded, fed to the financial sector. And they have propped up most markets, but have pushed down too. And gold and silver are not being allowed to really signal the inflationary alarm, because what would happen then? People would run out of the stock market, or at least question the stock market. So back to your question about gold, right? And gold and silver with regards to the inflationary environment we are going through. What I was doing actually with this one client that we were reviewing his gold positions, because having a very big account, he had acquired quite a lot of good companies throughout the year, and we wanted to review where we were at. So what I did, I separated it into three sections. One was the producers, the developer explorers that we have bought over the last year, and then the developers and then the explorers. So three separate sections. What was interesting is that the biggest capital losses right now are in the explorers. But that's exactly like the Warren Buffett in 1998. That's where the value is. You know, if you look at Agnico, Agnico's producing gold around 650 US, Canadian, sorry, but they're selling it out at 1800. That's the case with all the gold producers right now. They're very profitable. Cash flows are rich, and they're acquiring each other, but they're down 40%. Well, guess what? That's the Warren Buffett entry point, 98, 99, when nobody wanted to get out of their growth stocks to get in. Now, is that going to change? Yes, it will. Because I think at some point what we're going to get is a massive rise up in gold and silver just to catch up to copper and all the other commodities, right? It doesn't make sense that silver's sitting here at $22 when copper's at $430, when the bulk of silver production comes from copper mines as a byproduct. So copper silver out of copper mines is being produced at a much higher cost than silver out of silver mines. So those inconsistencies will not last. When are they unwind? I don't know. But at some point they're going to go. The next point that was really important is when we looked at the developers. Now the developers are a different animal, because what you're doing there is buying reserves on the ground already bought. And there for the gold reserves that we bought throughout the year, we're paying about $80 to $70. Well, they're only down about 10% right now, which signals that reserves on the ground are holding their value. These companies are fully cashed up and the mines are being built. Where the big gains were in the explorers. Well, we've had three or four that have done extremely well with working in Canada, in Chile, in other areas. Now, that's a different animal. There we have profits now of north of 150 to 200%. Because it's always the rule that if you have six of them and you have one that hits, that in the exploration spectrum, well, that's going to pay for the capital you put into the others. You have to diversify that hit. And that's really, that's where over the last year, we saw a lot of gains in the good quality explorers. Now, that's a healthy market for me, because what does that signal? That the smart money is going into the explorers, there's smart money sitting on developers and just waiting, but the money hasn't come in into the producers yet. And that's because the big institutional money is still chasing the Dow or sitting on fixed income rates at about 1%, which is a big problem, because at some point they're going to have to come over, right? So either gold and silver are going to rise higher and then they're going to come in, or they're going to realize that that is a hell of an opportunity to enter. Mm-hmm.
So Jaime, when you talk about the attitude that's changing, it almost seems like you were bringing greed into the picture when... Really, fear first and then greed second, it seems like, when people don't think that things are going to go back down. So, you know, you talk about having an allocation to blockchain. So how do you treat those assets around when you see these all-time highs and subsequent declines after that? So do you rebalance your weighting to it once you see it starting to roll over? Or how do you treat that?
The beauty of the portfolios right now is this, is that I made my money in blockchain from in the year 2020 right into about the middle of 2021, mm-hmm. right? Asset allocation is key because I got in heavy right at the bottom and we rode it up. But the benefit within the speculative portfolio that I have, which is silver producers, gold producers, and blockchain producers, right? With blockchain having only a 20% weighting, okay? Now, what happened was that 20% weighting kept getting overly weighted to 40%. So we would always trim back.
Right.
Thanks to that, we were able to capture, I think last year, that portfolio returned about 200%. But the bulk of that was from that 2,400% move within the blockchain. Now, I kept trimming back and buying producers at ridiculous prices. So all I did is add more producers. Mm-hmm. Now, so in essence, I'm already out of the blockchain and now I'm just managing my position, what's remaining from that upside, waiting for the next move. But I do think that the big move over the next year is going to come from the producers, gold and silver producers, because that's where the true value is. And that value is fundamentally the lifeboat of the Titanic. Mm-hmm. And people don't understand that we do have, the Titanic is sinking. The financial Titanic is sinking. You know, it's funny because look, we have 3 Fed officials quit in the US so that they can sell out their accounts. If that isn't a signal of a top, and then on top of that, we had, what was it? The Dutch central banker and the German central banker that both retire in order to get out of the markets and step aside, right? So you have the crew getting shipped. That should be a signal to you that something big is afoot. Now, I have also always said that it's not up to the US. The US is all noise because that's like Britain in 1933. The real player, he who's going to pull the strings is going to be China. And that's what we have to be looking at, because what's happening in the Chinese real estate market right now is 2008 massively levered. And people tend to forget that the Chinese created that bubble so that they could bail out the West in 2008. And what was the cost for that? 20,000 tons of gold, right? That's when the gold starts leaving the West. Mm-hmm. We know that because it was re-smelted from pound bars to kilo bars to end up in China. So if you look at the geopolitical moves that are happening with China, that's also creating a lot of the supply crunch. And that's only going to get worse once they grab Taiwan. And they will grab Taiwan because Xi already said in the last 5-year plan that what they're trying to rebuild is China as it was before the British got involved in the 1880s with the silver wars. No, the opium wars, right? Mm-hmm. It's funny because people are myopic, but the Chinese aren't. They're very broad in how they look at the world. I don't think they want to conquer the world, but they definitely want China back. And Taipei and Taiwan are part of that. What's the problem for us? That the bulk of semiconductor production is in Taiwan, and we got to rebuild those supply lines. So they mm-hmm. really have us by the... cojones, if you want
to. Great, great PC answer, and hopefully you don't get in trouble for it being in Canada.
But well, it wasn't on that list of words that I can't.
It's not.
Anymore.
Yeah, it's not on that list. Yeah. Jaime, before we move on to China, I just want to kind of get your thoughts around. You know, there's a lot of people say that metals and cryptos are seen as inflation sensitive assets. So why do you think that the metals are being left behind versus the cryptos at this point?
Well, I think the metals are being left behind because the price is not allowed to rise to the same way that copper and everything else is rising, right? There's a lot of politics in the price of gold rising, but that doesn't mean that the Russians, the Chinese, the Turkish, the Turks, the Kyrgyzstan, and all the other central banks around the world are mm-hmm. stupid enough not to be buying physical gold at these prices, which they are, right? So it's not that they're being left behind. It's just that the manipulation of all markets that has been taking place has pushed up the stock market, but kept two down. And that narrative will change at some point. When it does, what I've always kept saying was the longer it takes, the bigger the fiscal imbalance, and it's a big imbalance, the higher the prices will correct. That is the patience trade, mm-hmm. right? Because that is about a systemic shift within the currency reserve, right? There was a great chart that came out comparing trade flows between China and the US from the year 2000 to the year 2020, where the bulk of trade of the world is being done with China. Well, why are they going to continue to use the US dollar? It's mm-hmm. silly to expect that. Well, they're ready to pull the plug. The question's when, and these all of the critical issues that are happening already with regards to Evergrande and everything, to me, it's that we're getting nearer and nearer that point. Mm-hmm.
So considering that over the last 20 years, trade has really shifted, and we'll put that chart in the video here. Considering that trade has really shifted away from the US and towards China, what is the path forward for the US dollar if this continues?
You know, it's funny because if you look at history, the further back you can see, the more into the future we can grasp. Well, go back to 1933. China can do exactly what Roosevelt did in 33 mm-hmm. to pull the power away from the British pound onto their side and control all of the factors of production, which is inflation, by backing a brand new yuan by their 20,000. So look at the mechanics of China. China took over 20,000 tons from the West to China through the Perth Mint. It went in. That's where we track this, right? But it's not sitting within the Chinese central bank. Mm-hmm. It's sitting in the Chinese citizens. So you have 20,000 tons right now that's sitting on the hand of Chinese citizens who have also purchased homes from these conglomerates that have not finished their homes or not finished building them because they're cash strapped, there's credit issues. Well, wouldn't it be easy for China to say to the Chinese, you know, those 20,000 tons of gold you have, I'm going to buy them from you at $5,000 US an ounce. Now you've recapitalized the Chinese people so that those homes can get finished. And then a couple of weeks later, you say, well, from this point forward, we're going to reset up a brand new yuan, which they've already said they will do, backed by something physical and real like gold, which they've already said they would do in order to participate in the SDR. But we're going to do it at $10,000, mm-hmm. right? That's exactly what Roosevelt did in 33. Why can't the Chinese do it? I think that being a Sun Tzu follower, that's exactly what I would do. Now, why is Russia, who is so tied to China, gone from what, 700 tons to almost 2,500 tons, if not over that, over all of these years? Because they know the play. Now, those geopolitical shifts that take over time is what fascinates me. Because when you look at history, it's clear what can be done right now. And you know what? That is the way that power has transferred for 4,000 years. So I love when people say, oh, it's different this time. Really? So mm-hmm. are we really going to bet against 4,000 years of monetary tradition? Mm-hmm. Anybody that does that is ignorant, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. And you know what? It's going to go back to, it wasn't never your money. Because the value of that money written in US dollars just got devalued as it did in 33. Mm-hmm. It's the only way we can deal with the debts and the inflation, everything that's happening. So there is no other way. The rest is all noise. Mm-hmm.
So when we think about that attitude, Jaime, of this time it's different, I've just finished reading a book by that very title by Reinhardt and Rogoff. Mm-hmm. Are there any indications that it might actually be different this time? Or are we heading into the culmination of many different bubbles that weren't ever allowed to really fully correct?
You know what? A $1.9 trillion overnight repo cost is different this time because that's a hell of a lot of money, right? It's funny because the Fed's telling us they're going to what? Taper $15 billion a month. Mm-hmm. Well, guess what? Their balance sheet's at $16 trillion, which is $16,000 billion. And they're only going to do $15 billion? Yeah. You know, that's like me telling you, you know what? Yeah, I'm a millionaire. Here's 5 cents for you to just shut up and I'm going to move forward. Mm-hmm. Come on. people have to look at the zeros behind all of these numbers and start to make some realistic assumptions of, the only thing that's different this time is that the bubble is exponentially bigger than it ever was, because in prior periods, we were limited by the printing press, by the physical need to print dollars using a printing press versus pushing numbers on a keyboard to create more zeros, right? And that's why this time, when this corrects, it's going to be a massive eye-opener. And inflation is signaling that already. Mm-hmm. Copper at 430 isn't falling. Forget what lumber prices are doing. Forget what oil prices. All those are much more, inelastic or elastic. I always get those two. Then copper. Copper you can't mess around with. That's the global barometer. And the fact that it's sitting at 430, well, guess what? It's not going to break down. I'm talking to my clients in Chile. I'm talking to clients in Mexico. The demand from China for copper to control copper supplies around the world is huge. So these prices aren't coming down. Mm-hmm. And their biggest issue with them is the fact that when do they stop paying in US dollars and start dealing in yuan?
So, Jaime, you know, as we're talking about China here, I remember some months ago looking at the PPI chart for Chinese producers, and it was just spiking to all-time highs. And here we are, you know, a couple months down the road, and we see the exact same from US producers. And, you know, as part of that, now we can look at the debt defaults and the control that the Chinese government is trying to have over these defaults. Do you think that China could really be a canary in the coal mine and, you know, showing us the path forward for what could happen here?
Definitely, because China's in control. China is the new leader for the global economy for this coming century, right? So it's up to them to pull the triggers. Now, luckily for the CPI or an inflation numbers, they're going to change the way they calculate it again. So it's going to come down again. It should come in at about 4.5% so people can sleep better. However, let me say one thing. So we just crossed 7, and 7 was a very important number, and it raised a lot of eyebrows because 7 was the number that they needed to get it down from the 80s. Okay. However, they don't calculate inflation in the same way we calculate in the 80s. We're using this new math, not the old math. If you use the old math, inflation's north of 15 to 16%, and people are feeling it. So the real question is this: at what point do more than 10% of the participants in the players in the game say, forget this and throw the towel and run the other way? Why? Because always 90% of the people are going to lose out. It's at 5 to 10% that are the early adapters that are running into the lifeboats that save themselves. Again, I always use that analogy. You're at a theater watching a movie, Star Wars, opening night, and smoke starts to rise from somewhere. How many people have to run out of the building before you have the mad rush? Mm-hmm. Well, it's about 7 to 10%. After that, it's over. You have a massive trample, right? And I think that's where we are. And I think we're there because I'm hearing it in the conversations. I'm reading on Twitter. I'm reading on LinkedIn, the replies that I'm getting from people, right? More and more people are questioning and losing faith. But I think more importantly, that questioning process of becoming aware that something's wrong happened at the beginning of the year. We have now is that actions are being taken. And that's why I think the Fed, although the wording is also losing traction with the main players. And you see that in the underlying factors of the stock market itself. I was reading a great report where hedge funds are getting out, big pension funds are getting out, raising cash. It's funny because with another time we were reviewing dividend stocks, and I was really surprised that Enbridge, I hadn't looked at it in about 2 to 3 weeks, that the dividend yield had gone above 7%. Again, a clear signal that pension funds who mostly own Enbridge are starting to break down and go out of the trade, right? So they're starting to raise cash at the very same time that the retail investor continues to run into the Dow because it's different this time, right?
Jaime, we kind of touched on Russia there, and you know we don't often talk about it because they don't pull as much attention as, let's say, China or the US. But you know they've been increasing their gold purchases as well this year. They seemingly have control over Europe, you know, exclusively by exporting their gas to help heat and power it. So is Russia in a much more advantageous spot than most other countries?
Well, answer this way, Tom. So look at Russia. Russia is the only country with no internal debt because we've been selling energy. And all of that gold purchases is not coming from debt. It's coming from actual profits of their energy sales, which instead of taking home US dollars or euros, they're taking home gold. Mm-hmm. So that should give you a signal as to where they're going, because who's going to be their main buyer? It's going to be Europe and China, right? And I'm sure China, they're going to want to get paid in gold. The real thing with Russia is that they're not big enough. They're just a massive producer of food and energy, right? But 30 million people, I think it is. And they have nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. So they can, and they're good fighters as well. So they're not, you know, they're not going to give up very easily. But I think it's a powerful player, but I think it's also kind of like the doorman for China, the bully. So what do you call it? The guy that stands in front
of
the bouncer. Yeah, mm-hmm. I think they're more of the bouncer. And, you know, I'm looking at the noise with Ukraine and all they're building troops on their side of the border. I don't think Putin's going to want to start a war with Ukraine because he already has Crimea. That's the mm-hmm. only thing that's important to Russia is Crimea, because it gives them access to the only freshwater port for their navy. Right. So they're going to definitely hold on to that. I think Ukraine is more noise, and it's Ukraine that wants Russia to invade so that they can get more money out of NATO, right? Again, follow the money in all these situations, mm-hmm. right? What happened, you know, all this noise increase, and especially the talk out of, what's his name, that was with Victoria Nuland, because NATO said that they weren't going to give them the arms that they were expecting, right? So that happened this week. I think the big play here is Nord Stream 2, the fact that it hasn't been allowed to enter. And that's politics, so that the Russians can start shipping some more energy through Ukraine and maybe Poland. But they're saying, well, no way, we'll just sell it to the Chinese. Mm-hmm. So that is an interesting situation, but I don't think it's going to lead to any war. I think Putin is way smarter than that. He's the chess master of geopolitics, as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm. And as we look at, you know, all these central banks that seemingly really trust gold and have these long histories with it, they've all been stacking gold and buying physical inventory. So is that, you know, another example of what we would consider the smart money trying to get ahead of the curve?
Of course. You know, I think all central banks are doing it. You know, mm-hmm. I think it's funny. Mexico, a lot of my Mexican clients are getting their money out of Mexico. It's looking similar to Argentina, Brazil, because they're feeling the inflation, right? I think a lot of those central banks that either came out of the Soviet republics, it's funny because it's the people that have felt inflation driven by central bank money printing or the abuses of the governments, like the Soviet republics, that understand that, because it's still fresh in their minds of the generations that the older generations, right? Mm-hmm. Or in Latin America, generations of my ilk. Right. Where they felt it. So they see it. The problem in North America is if we have not gone through one of these storms, and I'm talking about currency reserve shift, because we've benefited since 1933 out of having been beside the U.S. as the leader of that front when the U.S. became the currency reserve. But if you look at it from a historical perspective, you know, everybody's talking about the debt ceiling. The real debt ceiling was in 75. That's when the clock starts ticking. When I say the longer it takes, I'm talking about the last 50 years. I'm not talking about since the Fed, because that was the real debt ceiling when they broke through the gold standard so that they can start increasing debts exponentially, mm-hmm. right? That's really the beginning of this debt bubble. And now we're at the end, and it's been a long 450 years now. So yeah, it's gone a long time. So, you know, we're waiting in the last 5 minutes of the game here, and it's been a pretty good, you know, we just have to wait for the raffle to be done to see how it ends up. But, you know, if you use history as your guide, I think you, to me, in these periods is the best thing. You know, I love that Hemingway quote, how did you go bankrupt, or how did you go broke? Slowly and then gradually. Well, they were talking about 1929 and the shifts that occur at that period, right? Mm-hmm. How are we going to, you know, I'm sitting here in Toronto. I'm at the condo. I'm looking at all these buildings that have been built. Right? They're everywhere in every city that I go to throughout the world. Well, we haven't paid for them. We borrow the money to build them. So we've wasted the resources, but the monies that we borrowed the money in are devaluing, right? The US dollar is strong, but it's also because the other currencies are devaluing. So it's like boats coming down in a bucket where the water is draining, right? Mm-hmm. So, but how are we going to consolidate all of the equity that we've already spent against those assets that are disappearing? People have to understand that that's what gold for. That's why the gold reserves that all the central banks have between them have to rise, to the value of all these buildings that we've already spent the money so that we can reset the system. That simple mechanic has worked for 4,000 years. Bitcoin's not going to be it. Blockchain is a different animal. Blockchain is a technology that is going to decentralize us, which is great, right? Mm-hmm. And that's why the current central banks don't like it, but it's being adopted, right? So it's how high does the gold supply between all central banks at the lead of China, because they will have the most, about 25,000 or 37,000 tons, will have to rise for China alone to rebalance all of that equity that they've already spent in companies that are going bankrupt because they can't pay off those debts, right? The buildings are built, but what's the true value in gold so that we can reset the monetary system and then restart again? That mechanic is exactly the simplicity of the monetary transfer that we're about to see. Mm-hmm.
So Jaime, what role do you think that blockchain is going to play in this reset or a new currency system?
The best way to answer that is this. Once the ship sinks, are we going to ask the crew of the Titanic to help us rebuild it? No, we're going to build it anew. Mm-hmm. And the best way to answer this is go back to the last time that we went through a transitionary change of the social contract. Because this is about the social contract. I heard actually on Joe Rogan a really good interview with a doctor talking about the whole COVID thing. And the one thing that was important was that he talked about the social contract, because he said, look, people are being asked to get vaccinated to stay employed. But what if the negative consequences of that affect me in 5 years? Are you going to guarantee my employment for 5 years? So there is a social contract that's always being built between our relationship between us and society. Okay. Back to blockchain. What blockchain is a way of rebuilding it. So if we were talking in the year 1770, and I was saying, you know, the world's going to change, and Tom, you're going to have a say. The first thing you would have said to me in the year 1770, what's the king going to say about that? Mm-hmm. Well, guess what? 10 years later, the king had no say in the republics that were born. We had to rebuild the system completely. Well, that's exactly what we're going to do again. And the beauty of it now is that what the period of the 1770s left us is with a beautiful constitution. And I'm talking about the U.S. Constitution, the separation of power, and how it works. Because that's exactly why the U.S. is kind of starting to break away from this authoritarian world that we're trying to build. But by the same token, Americans say, forget that, you know, look at the football games alone. I don't see any mass. Well, so the social contract is starting to shift. What's going to happen now, though, is that we're not going to rebuild regionally. Now we have the opportunity, thanks to the internet that has interconnected us all, to go decentralize, where we're not going to need a lot of the traditional things from the past that were completely centralized. Because the problem is the centralization of the system, where you have, 15 central bankers around the world dictating all of us. You know, at sooner or later, that 10% of the people are going to realize, you know, the central banks are the problem. We're going another way. And I'm sure China's going to have to do that because of the inflationary pressures of the people and everything. Right. And the rest are just going to be left behind. But as we rebuild it, to me, blockchain is the decentralized tool to rebuild a new future. So I see them in tandem, but separate, because one is the technology, which is going to allow us to rebuild and maybe transact, but the value of things has to transfer to a constant that we can all trust. Mm-hmm. And that's what gold is. Mm-hmm.
A value that we can all trust and that will, you know, for maybe a couple hundred years, constrain governments at that point to stay within their, to spend within their means at that point, right?
Correct. Mm-hmm. Correct. Right. And I think blockchain will play, you know, and I see the, you know, Michael Saylor, when he talks about Bitcoin as a store of value. Yes, it's working. It's volatile. But I do think that gold would also play that factor. But the real benefit is going to come from the revenue increase or the revenue pickup of the producers as all of that kicked in. Right. Mm-hmm. That's really where I'm expecting the bulk of my growth to occur. And that's why I'm very happy to be sitting on 80% gold and silver producers and only 20 to 25% in crypto producers.
Mm-hmm. Excellent, Jaime. Is there anything else you'd like to touch on before we wrap up here?
No, I just think that, you know, we're going through a very interesting period in the world where a lot of noise, a lot of a lot of changes are occurring. And I think 2022 will be very interesting. Now, the one thing I would warn people is to be on the lookout, because when we get to these types of periods where something's bound to break, when it breaks, it's going to play out over a 48-hour period, and that catalyst will kind of release everything, release a lot of tension. Mm-hmm. And when that occurs, a lot of factors are going to start to fall. The dominoes are going to fall behind each other. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm looking for. You know, when you look at the pressures in the repo market, when you look at the pressures out of China, look at what China's doing right now in terms of maintaining their currency pegs because of the unwinding of the real estate sector. Mm-hmm. Look at what's happening in Australian bonds because how much yields have spiked, even though the Australian Central Bank wants to keep them flat because of its relation to China. So whatever's happening in China right now, I think is where the earthquake is going to come from. And that's what I always expected, because they are going to be the new leader. And don't think that periods of instability are bad, because period of instability is usually when those that have the power pull the plug on things, because that's when people tend to be the most reliant on following you. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Apart from that, thanks for having me again. Want to wish everybody a happy holiday season. Enjoy your families. I think it's a time to just sit back, meditate, and understand that we are a big global community going through this. And there's a lot of tension that I see, I hear, but it will find a resolution.
Maybe shut the news and Twitter off a little bit during that time, right?
And hug your family.
Yeah.
Correct.
Absolutely. Yeah. Jaime, well, I really appreciate your time and getting to chat with you again. Of course, you're available on Twitter at IJ Carrasco and Jaime Carrasco on LinkedIn. Anywhere else you want to point to?
No, that and work. I don't know if you followed Canaccord this year, but we've had an amazing year. The gold team has been doing an unbelievable. So I'm always happy to do a plug for Canada's top independent firm. Great place to be and to be allowed to think the way I think.
Absolutely. Jaime, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you, Tom.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.